Stand and
we'll stand with Bill.
With Bill.
And I'll stand as a minister.
Okay.
Let's go. First word on loving kindness. Tani yamasa kusalena yanta. I'm sorry, wrong one.
Show off.
This is what should be done.
By one who is sealed in goodness and who knows the path of peace, let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, are meeting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwardly unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be as divine abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure heart at one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
I just take the opportunity to center yourself. Recollect what your meditation subject is. Just fix your mind there. If your mind drifts, just bring it back. And the Dhamma that we discussed today will enter. So, I think today I'll talk about the Triple Gem. The Triple Gem refers to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. The Buddha, the Enlightened One, the Dhamma, his teachings, and the Sangha, his enlightened followers. Often when we go to a monastery, if we're a Buddhist, we'll do some chanting, and one of the things that we chant is Buddhang Saratnang Gacchami, Tammang saratnam gacchami, Sanghang saratnam gacchami. That's the Pali. That's the language of the Lord Buddha. And what that means is, Buddhang saratnam gacchami means, I go to the Buddha for my refuge. I take refuge in the Buddha, if you like. And the same with the Dhamma, and the same with the Sangha. In other words, you're basically committing yourself to follow in the Buddha's footsteps. You're placing your respect, your trust, and your faith in those three things: the Buddha, his teachings, and those enlightened followers that came after him. So what exactly does that mean? Clearly, we're not placing our faith, our trust, our respect in the Buddha's statue that you see at the shrine when you bow and chant, those words. That's just an image. It's there simply to make you recollect the virtues of the Buddha, the virtues of his teaching, and the virtues of those who followed after him. And it's not there to give you faith and comfort in his physical body, because that no longer exists. That was burnt centuries ago. Thousands, 2,000, maybe 2,600 years ago. So, what are we talking about when we say we'll place our respect, we go to the Buddha for our refuge? Well, the Buddha is our shining example. He's the one who discovered the nature of reality and found that it was to be suffering. And he not only realized that life is suffering, but he also found a way out. And even more than that, he explained for others to hear the path that leads to enlightenment and freedom from suffering. So the Buddha, we respect the Buddha because he's our inspiration. His life was full of challenges. Even though he was born to a wealthy family in the Sakya clan in northern India, a prince, his father was king, mother queen. It's said, there are various versions, I guess, or variations on the life of the story of the life of the Buddha. Obviously, there's some truth to it, but there's a lot of myth and legend associated with it as well. It's said that his mother had a dream of a white elephant entering her right side, and this dream was auspicious. And the Brahmins at the time forecast that this would mean that she would give birth to a special human being. So she was looked after and cared for. And I think the story goes that she was going to travel to the kingdom where she came from while she was still pregnant. But while she was travelling along the way, it became apparent that she was going to give birth. And she gave birth in the garden, standing up, and it's supposedly holding onto a tree. And the child was born out of the side of his mother. And was fully formed And when he was born, he took 7 steps from day one, from being born immediately, was able to walk. And he was taken off to the back to the palace, and the Brahmins came and had a look at the child, and they looked for the signs of a great person. And there are 32, all of which I can't remember. But basically, when you look at a Buddha image, many of those features tend to be incorporated, like blue-black hair, it's curly blue-black hair, long fingers that are all the same length, long arms that went down to his knees, long earlobes, pointed head, and the wheel of life on the soles of his feet. And those sorts of things, these signs of a great being. And the Brahmins looked for all these signs and predicted that the Lord Buddha, depending as to, they predicted that he could be one of two things. He could be a wheel-turning emperor, and bearing in mind that he was born to a warrior class and his father was king, or he could be a great ascetic, a great religious person. So having heard this, his father decided that he wanted his son to become a wheel-turning emperor. In other words, someone who could conquer the world, someone who could rule the biggest empire that there's ever been. This was the future that his father saw for him. But he knew, when through talking with the Brahmins, that there was a chance that the Lord Buddha would take the other alternate path. So his father went to great lengths to ensure that during the child's growing up, he would have nothing but the best. He would experience nothing but pleasure. And bearing in mind that his mother died shortly after he was born. So the father was the sole parent. So he had a nursemaid, Mahaprajapati, who later actually ordained as the first nun. And his father ensured that any old, sick, infirmed person was to be removed from the grounds of the palace and from the nearby village. The prince was to be surrounded only by young people, attractive people. He was to have the best of foods, the best of drink, and be in this world where every sensual pleasure was to be fulfilled. He had the best educators, Brahmins would teach him. And so life was pleasurable for the Buddha. For many years, he learned, he trained as a soldier, he trained to be a leader, and everything seemed to be going right for his father's wish. But it said that inside, basically, there was something urging him to look beyond the walls of the palace. He couldn't quite work out what it was, but he felt the need to go and see some more of life. So he, despite his fact that the fact that his father had forbidden him from going outside to see the outside world, he persuaded his chariot driver to take him for a quick trip outside. And reluctantly, the chariot driver agreed. And they went beyond the palace walls. And the first thing that he saw was an old man. And he asked the chariot driver, well, what's this? Because he'd never seen anybody aging before. Because as soon as someone showed any signs of aging, his father had them removed from the prince's palace, from the prince's presence. And the charioteer said, oh, that's an old person. And the Lord Buddha pondered, what's age? What's all this about? Anyway, they did this four more occasions. And then he saw a sick person. And the charioteer said, oh, this is someone who's not well. They have a physical illness. And he saw a corpse. And the charioteer had to explain that beings die, people die. And this is something unheard of to the Buddha, never seen before. And finally he saw a mendicant, a holy man. And all this caused the Buddha to think, what is life really about? This is something I haven't seen or experienced before. And in that time, he in fact got married and was ready to take on his princely role. He even had his wife was pregnant. But all of this was troubling him. There had to be something else. There was something missing in his life. And on the day that his son was born, he left the palace. Because he knew that his family would be in good hands, they would be looked after. He set out on his quest to find the meaning of life, because he felt that life in the palace wasn't everything that there was to experience. And he called his son Rahul, which effectively means a fetter, something which locks you down, it ties you to the world. So he realized that it was now or never. He was either going to be a family man, a great warrior, or he was going to take on the quest for the meaning of life. So he decided to take on the quest, and he left with his charioteer. And after they were a safe distance away from the palace, he cut off his hair and gave all his possessions to the charioteer and told him to go back and tell his father what had happened. And he went off in search of teachers, in search of people who could help him develop his mind so that he could understand the nature of the world. And he endured great hardship. He walked wherever he went. He no longer had a chariot. He wasn't a prince anymore. His only robes were what he could find by the side of the road. Food was whatever people would share with him. And he found various teachers along the way, and they were all able to help him a little bit. They all sort of incrementally allowed him to develop his concentration and his meditation. And while they were well renowned, those teachers, he was still dissatisfied with a level of attainment, even though he had attained everything and could do everything that his teachers had taught him. He still wasn't satisfied. There was still something missing. So he had phenomenal levels of concentration and able to attain deep states of samadhi. But yet those states themselves had to break up. He had to come back into the world as we know it. And he studied for a while. He decided to leave his final teacher and go off in search of another teacher. And he was practicing strict ascetic practices. And he had five companions. And he said to them, look, we've been practicing this for this way for quite some time, and I'm going to take some food. And they said, well, if you're going to break with the ascetic mold, we're leaving you. So the Lord Buddha was given some food, so the story goes, and again, stories vary, but the story goes that he was given some food, and he sat under the Bodhi tree on his own, and he sat there all night, and he went through all of the jhanas, all of the different levels of concentration, and then finally wisdom arose. Finally he could see through all his effort, all the work that he'd done to that point was focused on one thing, and that was seeing that this world is suffering. This world is impermanent. This world is devoid of self. There is nothing permanent in this world, and because of that we suffer. So we take refuge in the Buddha because he had the strength to go and practice where no one else had gone. No one was able to teach him any of this. He was a self-enlightened Buddha, a self-enlightened being. And if he hadn't have been so courageous and so brave, then there wouldn't have been a Buddhism. It's only through his devotion, his effort, his discipline that we're able to practice, that we're sitting here today able to talk about meditation, able to talk about what is good in the world. And that's why we go to the Buddha for our refuge. We don't go to anything physical. We go because we're paying respect to the effort that he made, because we are so thankful of the effort that he made, because that gives us the opportunity to follow in his footsteps. That's why we take refuge in the Buddha, because of the great person and the sacrifice that he made in order to help all of us. After he'd been sitting under the Bodhi tree for a few days, I can't remember how many, he looked around with his divine powers to see if it would be worthwhile teaching anybody. Because at first, so the story goes, he was reluctant to even think that anyone else could possibly understand something so profound that he had discovered. But then with his divine eye, he was able to see that the five followers that he had before, the five mendicants that were students with him, could possibly understand the Dhamma. So he travelled to them to find them, and he caught up with them. And he taught them the very first teachings of the Dhamma, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and it encapsulated the very essence of Dhamma. And as they listened, the five followers became enlightened just through listening, because their minds were so developed, their concentration had been so strong. They just lacked the final piece of knowledge to take them to the next level. And as soon as the Buddha was able to explain the Dharma to them, they too became enlightened. And that was the start, not only of the Dharma, the teaching of the Dharma, but also of the Sangha, the order of monks. Not just the order of monks, the order of those who are enlightened, monks or otherwise, monks predominantly. So, what was that? When we say then we go to the Buddha for a refuge, that's what we're talking about. So what about where we go to the Dharma for a refuge? Well, the Dharma is the teaching. The Dharma explains the way that the world works. And it explains that the world is suffering. And it explains the way to practice, to alleviate suffering. Because in that first sutta, in that first teaching, the Lord Buddha explained the principles of the Four Noble Truths. Now, the Lord Buddha didn't invent Dharma. He didn't make it up. It wasn't something that he constructed. It's something he discovered. He was able to tap into it. Because the Dharma will exist, the way of the world will be the way of the world forever and a day. But whether there is any being around that actually understands how it works, that's the issue. And what the Lord Buddha was able to do by himself was to understand the way that this conditioned world works. So he taught the Four Noble Truths. The noble truth of suffering, that life is conditioned phenomena, a subject of birth, aging, sickness and death. And the cause of suffering is wanting, craving, desire, whatever you want to call it. You want something to be, to exist all the time. You don't want something to disappear. Or you do want something that exists to break up and disappear. Or you want for sensual pleasure. Those three forms of craving, those three forms of desire, are basically what causes suffering. When things that you want are gone from you, you're unhappy. When things that you don't like are present and in your senses all the time, then you're unhappy. If you want for sensual pleasure, again, the pleasures of the senses are transitory. When they're gone, you're unhappy, suffering. So, the last few weeks we've talked a little bit about karma, cause and effect. And here, cause and effect is prevalent in the Four Noble Truths, because the Lord Buddha said, if you eliminate the cause of suffering, you will eliminate suffering. And then he said, the way to do that is to practice the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path basically says that to start with, you have to have right view. There has to be some acknowledgement that the path that the Lord Buddha laid out is in fact the right path. So you have to not only have faith, but you have to practice to realize for yourself that the Four Noble Truths are in fact truisms. We call them the Ariyasaccha because they are immutable. They are always true. It doesn't matter which aeon you are, there is, which period in time, those four truths will always be true. Always. So you then have to understand that and have the right view in terms of cause and effect. You have to also understand what is right and what is wrong, or what leads to good outcomes and what leads to not so good outcomes. That's again part of right view. And you need to understand what feeds into that understanding. I mean, the body obviously is supported by food, water, air, and the mind is supported by contacts made through the senses, feelings. You have to understand, therefore, what's driving your existence. Because if you don't understand those things, or you don't have the right view about them, for example, those things which lead to unwholesome outcomes you believe are worthwhile, you believe in things like hatred, anger, and think that it's good to be angry because you can get your own way. Wrong view. You have to have a right intention or right thought. And that means that you have to embrace the idea of renunciation. So, well, by renunciation, that doesn't mean to say we all have to pack up and go and live in the forest. I mean, that's great for monks, and if you can do it, all well and good, because you find peace and quiet in the forest. But it also means to have what we call citta viveka, which means that you have peacefulness of your mind. So you renounce things that are troublesome to the mind. You try and declutter your mind and declutter your environment so that you're not as easily aroused as you would otherwise be. So you make your life as simple as you can. That's renunciation. And you practice loving kindness. And you practice compassion. So you wish all beings, may they be happy. So if you set your mind in that way, then you're practicing right intention. And the first two steps along the path. Right speech. We practice right speech. Means that we don't tell lies. We don't engage in slanderous speech or speech designed to be harmful. That makes you more trustworthy. Makes people get on with you a lot better if they know that you don't tell them a lie. They know that you're always going to be truthful. People will believe in you and will have confidence in you and will help you. Right action really means keeping the precepts. Whether you're keeping 5 precepts, 8 precepts, 10 precepts, 227 precepts, 311 precepts, it doesn't really matter. So long as you're keeping your precepts and you're keeping them well. Clearly, the more precepts that you follow, the easier it will be for you to progress along the path. That's the purpose of having the precepts and the purpose of ordaining, so that you can have more time and be more committed to the practice. Right livelihood. This is a difficult one because there is no right livelihood. There's only things which are wrong livelihood. So dealing with munitions, guns, weapons, not right livelihood. Dealing with the slaughter of animals, not right livelihood. Anything which does harm to other people or causes you to be dishonest or deceitful, that's wrong livelihood and doesn't lead to enlightenment. Right effort, I explained last week and the week before. So I won't go into that in any more detail. But it really means giving up all the unwholesome practices that you have and developing all the wholesome ones and accruing more wholesome ones. So right mindfulness, again, I've explained that. It really means the four satipatthanas, the practice of mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of the thought processes, and mindfulness of Dhamma. And finally, excuse me, right samadhi, right concentration. And I've spent some time discussing that, so I won't go into that in any more detail either. So this is the Dhamma that was discovered by the Lord Buddha and which was taught by him. And we go to refuge in that because we embrace it as a practice. And if we don't, then why bother to practice? Why bother to meditate? Why bother to come to the monastery? It's that very teaching which is going to lead us. It's the roadmap, the way out of suffering. So it's worthy of our respect. It is precious. There is nothing more precious than the Dhamma. Nothing. And one of the reasons why I agreed to come on a Monday night to provide some guidance is because I want you to also understand how precious the Dhamma is and what an opportunity you have in front of you to practice. Don't waste the opportunity. Practice as much as you can. Practice in your daily life. Whenever you see yourself becoming angry, whenever you see yourself becoming greedy, try and invoke your own mindfulness and realize that this is an opportunity to forego those unwholesome traits, the things which defile the heart. That's what Dhamma is all about. That's why it's so precious, because in the end, if you practice it properly, you too can be free from suffering. And the third refuge is the Sangha. Now, Sangha has two meanings, really. In this sense, it means the body of those people who've been enlightened after the Buddha. In the second sense, it means the order of monks. But not every monk is enlightened, and not every monk is a good monk. In the Buddha's time, he had a cousin called Devadatta. And Devadatta, whilst he was a monk, he did some heinous things. He tried to change the way that the order of monks behaved. And he petitioned the Buddha. And the Buddha said, no, we're not going to do those things. For example, he wanted to be vegetarian, and the Buddha said, no, whatever people eat, that's what we'll eat. And so Devadatta actually threw a stone at the Buddha. And striking the Buddha is one of the most heinous things that any being can do from a bad karma perspective. And Devadatta caused a schism in the Sangha, and that's another heinous crime, basically, another very bad thing, if you're talking about karma. And so, yes, he might have shaved his head and worn yellow, but Devadatta is now in the hell realms. So the Sangha that we take refuge in is not just not just any old monk, not just any old person who shaves their head and wears yellow robes. It's those who are enlightened, or those who are Aryas, those who are on the path of enlightenment. And so we thank them also, because they're the ones who can give us guidance in this day. they're the ones who can put into practice the Dharma and show us the practical ways in which we can implement Dharma and be free from suffering ourselves. So that's why we take refuge in them. So I encourage all of you to understand what the Triple Gem is, to understand how precious that it is. And if you hold nothing else in your life to be precious, then you should still hold this, because it's the only thing which will free you from suffering. Anyone? That's enough for me. We'll sit in meditation now. With a musical jingle. Thanks, man. So, has anybody got any questions?
I've got a comment, I suppose. I think the 32 parts of the body are a myth. Because in other parts of the sutras, it's sort of said that Buddha was, you know, indistinguishable from the other monks.
Oh, you mean the 32 signs of greatness? Well, that may be true. It's a story.
Yeah, because the hands passed the knees and all that sort of stuff, and the tongue sort of being able to lick his ears or something or whatever, makes him sound like a freak rather than a sort of sort of person. But
bear in mind that that's not actually a Buddhist story, if you like. Because that's what the Brahmins deemed to be the signs of a great person. So the notion of those 32 components or 32 aspects of characteristics of a great person, that precedes Buddhism, precedes the Buddha.
I've heard that story as well, but I've also heard that it's not traceable in the Brahmin scriptures either, sort of thing.
Whether it is or whether it isn't, it is a story.
The place where it's sort of mentioned is in the Buddhist sutras.
Whether it is or whether it isn't, I don't know. But to some extent, it's irrelevant to the actual core of the story.
Mm.
But it lends itself to the story in the sense that because of at the time the Brahmins were the religious leaders, if you like, and it just puts it in context of that time. Now, if you could argue, well, the Brahmins never believed in that either. That's a different story, but it connects the notion of having these signs of greatness. Connects the story from the point of view of the Buddha having two alternate paths.
Mm.
And it's because of these signs of greatness that the Brahmins were able to tell his father, the king, that he would be a wheel-turning emperor or he would be a great religious leader. And it's because of the signs. And back then, and rites and rituals, Brahmins still believe in rites and rituals to this day.
Mm.
And rites and rituals are very popular back then, and signs were very popular in terms of, you know, religious context.
Mm.
And so it sets that scene that this is how they was able to know that he would be one or the other. But whether those signs are physical signs or not, to some extent, really doesn't matter.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. I will ask one question of you then. I'm obviously the one giving the talk, but it's sometimes difficult for me to actually just try and pitch the talk at the level of understanding, because you've got different people with the
group. Right.
So it's not a question for you, it's a question for everybody. Whether you find some of the topics difficult to understand, or because some of the things that I talk about, things that monks would, desanas that monks would give to monks, if you like, not necessarily for lay people. So I just wanted to really get some feedback. You like that? It's understandable. Good, because I don't want to sort of go at a level that people don't understand what I'm talking about.
It's good. It's enlightening for us.
Well, I hope so. But obviously, you need a base level, and I'm assuming a base level because everyone here comes regularly. So you've been coming for a while. So I'm assuming a base level of knowledge. Well, that's good. So for me, if you're happy, then obviously I'm happy.
I would make a distinction. Today's talk seemed a little different, that it was more about what you might expect if somebody wanted to introduce Buddhism with the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and all, and you've been talking, as monks often will, about the details of practice. And that's just fine. That's not a complaint in any way. I just noticed that you could have started with this talk, but as you say, you just talk.
Yes.
You know, from a sort of academic point of view, that would seem to come at the beginning, but it's come in the middle. And that's great. You know, but it was different tonight is the real point that I want to make. And I'm not, I haven't felt that you were going too simple or too abstract myself.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I could have done that at the beginning, but that's not where my heart was at that
time. That's right. Yeah, no, I'm not complaining.
No, it's
just the old academic in me that was organizing the syllabus. It occurred to me that, this is kind of like an introductory lesson, so what? It's what came tonight, and, but it was very different. than the previous talks. And that's what I really want to say, that I noticed and enjoyed the difference.
Yeah, I think you, well, I know you're right. But the thing for me, when we talk about the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, and I hope it came through in the talk, is that just how precious and how yes. important the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha is. And that was the whole, that was the only thing I really wanted to say. Yes, and it took me half an hour to get there. But,
I can feel the conviction in that when you said it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I think everybody's
good. Well, thank you for that. Okay, so over the building on the sounds of this.
Well, we thank you for being here. You know, it's really good. Thank you.
Oh no, you're more than welcome. I just want to make sure though that everyone's getting some benefit out of it.
Thank you.
Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration.
Rhythms that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all the virtues of the world, may the highest gods and equal forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nirvana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind, with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, and surpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme sword. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.